I want to start today with a little history lesson again. I've given little snippets of the past. 8 years ago, Hope Bible Church was meeting at Fulton Elementary School, which we rented for only a few hours each Sunday, and then had to pack up and vacate. Many of you remember all those packing days, and because you bore the burden of that. But then we had to meet in our home or other locations during the week, which greatly limited our ability to improve and advance those ministries. So we went on a search to secure this full-time facility. When we did that, the Lord brought, right at that time, a wave of new people, more leaders, increased financial backing, additional office workers, new small groups, and then more workers for the various ministries that needed volunteers and filling out. All because this church, many of you are still here in this church, stepped out in faith. And our people dedicated themselves to rent this facility, to outfit it. All that work you see here on the platform and behind me and throughout the various locations. Then to clean it and to maintain it. This very facility that we're in now. The history of this church demonstrates that a facility makes a difference in what we're able to accomplish. And it also makes us more visible as a body of believers in our community because we were basically unknown up until that point. It greatly enhanced our church now some 7 years ago. It put us on the map. And now, as we are on the cusp of finally, think about it, after 20 years of existence, owning our own facility. I don't know why 20 years always comes up in my life with that, because we were married 20 years before we could buy our first house. And now 20 years of ministry, and it looks like God is right on the brink of giving us the money for that. We are trusting God and His leadership and His provision for being able to purchase a full-time owned facility. It is true the church should never be reduced to a business. Those who do so misunderstand the church. But it is also true that a church has a lot of important business to do. And if you don't know that, you don't know too much about a local church. If it didn't do that business, the local church would literally crumble and cease to exist. I imagine that many of you come in here each Sunday and you see the building, the parking, how everything works on a Sunday, and you don't think about it too much or how much work has to go on behind the scenes to make all of this happen. The simple truth is, without regular generous giving and volunteering, our church staff would not be here and very little that you see taking place would happen and be accomplished. All that you see, whether it's on Sunday or throughout the week, takes money. And it takes hours of volunteer and ministry time. It does not just happen. You have to do your part also. That part, the Bible calls stewardship. And stewardship involves, as you've heard many times, the volunteering of time and talents and treasures. Money. Money is not evil. Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 18 says, "But you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is He who is giving you power to make wealth." So it can't be bad if God is giving us the power to make it. But here is the thing. The love of money is evil. 1 Timothy 6:10, "For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil." And he goes on to talk about how people who love money wander away from the Christian faith and end up shipwrecking their own souls. Hebrews 13:5 says this to all of us. "Make sure that your character is free from the love of money." How do you do that? Well, the next clause says, "Being content with what you have." That's the hard part, isn't it? 1 Timothy 3:3, "Elders in God's church are not to be, quote, addicted to wine or pugnacious, but gentle, peaceable," and then it says this, "free from the love of money." Simply put, the surest way to prove to yourself and to God that you do not love money is to be content with what you have and to give money to God's church and to the work of the Lord. We're even exhorted in 1 Timothy 6:18, and this covers every American just about, instruct those who are rich in this present world, compared to the other people in the world, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready, poised, that is, to share. Dr. John MacArthur writes, how people view money is an effective barometer of their spirituality. Money is neither good nor bad in itself. Corrupt people can put it to evil uses, while good people can put it to righteous uses. Though it is morally neutral, what people do with their money reflects their internal morality. In the words of Jesus, where your treasure is, there your what? Heart will be also, Luke 12:34. I'm as aware as you are that money is a touchy subject, especially in church. And it has been a touchy subject in church for a long, long time. After the waves of persecution the early Christians had experienced during the first three centuries of existence, many churches and bishops became rich while the poor around them suffered. And from the extravagant adornment of some church buildings we even see today and the lavish lifestyles of their leaders, money clearly gets abused by churches. Health and wealth gospel proponents in particular saturate the airwaves, assuring people that if they give, God will bless their business and make them rich. No, he will not. I remember a friend back at Forsey Church who was in a predicament because he was a salesperson and he would be telling the other people the truth that they wouldn't get their product until so many days, but other competitive salespeople were lying and telling them they'd get it sooner to make the sale, and then they still would get it later. And he determined that he would do the right thing and tell them the truth anyways, and he had some brethren come to him and say, God's going to really bless your business and make you rich. And he said, that never happened. He lost a lot of sales by telling the truth. But he gained a lot of joy, and he kept his integrity, which is a better kind of wealth. We all know that when religion and money mix, the manipulation of people of faith who are trying to believe God and give the money, that manipulation happens all the time, and it's a difficult thing. Furthermore, I want you to know that the elders know that you work very hard during the week. You earn your own money, and some of you work with unreasonable bosses, and you know that after you've worked all those hours, the demand on your money is incessant. Some of you now are going through difficult financial times. Sometimes that's because of poor decisions. Sometimes that's because other people have not been fair to you. My family has also known prolonged financial times that are difficult. I've been in seminary three times. Seminary is not a great place to get rich. It's not. 10 years teaching in Christian schools, they don't pay so well. And our church plant here in Maryland was very slow in growth for the first few years. And so you put all of that together. For the first 20 years of our marriage, Sue and I asked her about this. I said, I think we averaged under $25,000 of income every year for the first 20 years. And that's with children to take care of and coming along as well. So we know what it is to tighten a belt and to do without some things. At one point in years 4 through 6 of this church plant, we decided that we needed money to help the girls with their tennis ambitions. And so we started to deliver newspapers to cover the expenses for the kids. And at one point, we had 5 newspaper routes all at one time. To this day, my girls hate the smell of newspaper ink. But here is the thing. Though we could never even come close to a down payment on a home, we also were never in debt either. And we always gave 10% of our gross income to God's work. I tell you that not to brag. I have a lot of shortcomings. And whatever good that you might see in my life, Christ gets the credit for that. But it is important to me as I approach this subject that you not misunderstand me or the elders who want this preached, not for their benefit, they don't get paid, but for your benefit, that God might enrich your souls as you give. Sue and I were serving the Lord sacrificially long before you came to this church. And your increased giving is not going to buy me a jacuzzi. In fact, I have never handled the finances of Hope Bible Church. And any time anyone has moved to give a check and they come to me and they say, here's some money, I won't even accept it from them. You have to give that to somebody else, not to me. Other men and other women have taken excellent care of God's money in this church for 20 years. It's always been well cared for. Every dollar spent is out in the open, it's accounted for, and any member can ask about it at any time. And I also want to say this because today is a baptism Sunday, and I know we have guests here. I've been preaching now for 20 years, and this is only the second time in 20 years I've done a series on giving, because throughout most of the history, we didn't really need exhortations in that. But we do face a great challenge, and so I think it's a good time to kind of lay all the cards on the table and really talk about what God says about money. Because I know you're talking about it at home, and I know sometimes the things you're going to say are negative about the church. Why are they asking for money? And if you say you're not talking about it at home, you're a liar, because you know you're talking about it. So we're just going to get it all out on the table, and we're going to talk about that here together. God in his wisdom has designed the ministry to advance by the sweat and the sacrifice and the faith-giving of his people, his own people, who love him, who love his church, and who love the gospel. Sean read from Romans 8, he who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all. How will he not with Christ freely give us all things? A generous God like that surely cannot be outgiven. And it will be that kind of faith and that kind of an attitude that has to fill your mind and your heart, or you might think, but if I give this, I will do without. If I give this, I will lose. And if they ask me to give one more time, I'm going to be angry at them and leave. So hopefully that gospel will sink into your mind as we're going through all of this. Our text is not Romans 8, although that would be a great text. Our text is 2 Corinthians chapter 8. Which we read for our scripture reading. Please turn there since I read it already. I am not going to read it right now. We'll kind of read it as we go through verse by verse as I draw some principles from it. We really have in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and chapter 9 two whole chapters that brilliantly articulate God's design for giving to church work. I don't want to give a prolonged introduction to 2 Corinthians. Suffice it to say, for our purposes, that this epistle was written by the Apostle Paul to the Corinthian congregation about 55 or 56 AD, when Paul was at Macedonia after leaving Ephesus. Here in chapters 8 and 9, after dealing with many personal issues between himself and the Corinthians earlier in the letter, Paul is now motivating these Corinthians to finish taking up a monetary collection. They got started. He wanted them not to be affected by covetousness and to finish the collection. And the collection was to aid poor Jewish Christians living in Jerusalem and in Judea. These poor Christians formed the mother church of all the other local churches in the world. We know that because we just finished studying the church in its initial phases in Acts chapter 2, verses 42 through 47. Yet through the years, the church in Jerusalem had come to struggle financially. There was heavy taxation, there broke out persecutions, but also there had been a drought and a famine in the land. Paul had always taught that salvation was from the Jews. What did that mean? That's where the gospel started. It went out to all the other nations as God designed, but it started with the Jews. Jesus is the Jewish king. So he believed every Gentile church, like the Corinthians, predominantly Gentile, which Paul had founded in his missionary journey, they owed the mother Jewish church a debt of love and a debt of gratitude. And he wanted the bond between the Jewish church that initiated everything and the Gentile churches to be strengthened. And he knew that there could be a disunity between Jew and Gentile. And this offering was more than just taking care of the poor. It was about building unity within the broader church. So he was taking a collection from predominantly Gentile congregations and then loading it with people that were responsible and taking it by ship and by land to carry it back to the Jews. And he began the instruction about this collection actually back in his first letter to the Corinthians. Would you just keep your finger there and go back to the very end of 1 Corinthians in chapter 16 and look at verses 1 through 3. 1 Corinthians 16, 1 through 3. He writes there, "Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so do you also. On the first day of every week, that's Sunday, each one of you is to put aside and save as he may prosper, so that no collections be made when I come. When I arrive, whomever you may approve, I will send them with letters to carry your gift to Jerusalem." Notice he's very concerned with who carries the gift and how the gift is handled. And he said, "I want to make sure it's someone that you approve of as well." Now, it took Paul years to finish this collection, but he kept at it. He was successful in collecting this gift. In Romans chapter 15, verses 25 and 26, it says, "Now I am going to Jerusalem, serving the saints, for Macedonia," the churches in Macedonia, "and Achaia," that's where Corinth was, "have been pleased to make a contribution for the poor among the saints in Jerusalem." Wonderful, wonderful cause. In fact, in Acts chapter 20 and verse 4, it gives a list of all of the men who faithfully carried that large financial gift to Judea. But in order to make the collection successful, Paul still had here in 2 Corinthians to urge this congregation to finish giving. And for anybody who says that churches should never ask their people for money, I'd like you to tilt your head down again and read this section again. Because Paul engages in some pretty powerful godly persuasion here to give generously. The Liberty New Testament commentary makes this point. Paul is commonly credited with being a great theologian and missionary, but what is often not known of him is that he was also a great financial genius of the early church. So from this collection and these texts here that deal with that, we're going to draw out some godly principles for our own giving. I hardly ever borrow or steal someone else's sermon outline, but today I did. So I want to give the credit to Dr. John MacArthur for this outline, at least most of the outline, because I kind of just took it, okay? Giving principle number one, and you can write these down. If you don't and you're lazy about that today, it's okay, because Dr. Plumlee's already given a lot of this to you in writing, so you got it, okay? But if you write it down, you might get more out of it also. Look at verse 1. "Now, brethren, we wish to make known to you the grace of God, which has been given in the churches of Macedonia." Stop there. So Paul is writing to the church in Corinth, which is in Achaia, but he is presenting the example of the churches in another province called Macedonia, so that those in Achaia, Corinth, will emulate them. The grace of God mentioned in this verse refers to God moving hearts to give financially to the other brethren in Jerusalem. And so the principle here is that, and this is the first principle, giving is motivated by the grace of God already shown to us. Our financial giving is motivated by the grace of God already shown to us. The churches in Macedonia, do you know what churches those were? Philippi, Thessalonica, and Berea, and maybe others, were giving money to the poor Jewish Christians living in Judea. To their credit for giving, they ultimately themselves gave the credit back to the work of God's grace in their hearts. It is the grace of God that motivated all of the giving that you are going to read about here by the Macedonians. We need to remember that. It's very important. In other words, the financial giving that we're going to talk about in this passage, if we don't get the background of the grace of God, then we'll misunderstand the motivation for all of this. It is being convinced of the grace of God, having the grace of God work in your life, that motivates financial giving in church. And so Paul saw this financial contribution not just as an example of human generosity. It is that. He saw it as more. He saw it as evidence that the grace of God was at work in that congregation. And they're looking for evidence. They'd say, look, the evidence is they're emptying their pockets, or whatever the equivalent would be in the first century. That is very important for you and me to understand. These Macedonian believers were touched by the wonderful, merciful God that they served. They treasured the grace of God in their own lives. If you do, it humbles you. It makes you more thankful. It makes you more willing to give. They had thought about the sacrificial death of Christ, right? They sung songs about him. They contemplated the sacrifice. They knew that they'd been given riches from Christ and promised immeasurable riches, riches that cannot fade away and are reserved in heaven. And so they decided, look, here is an opportunity for us to give, and so they gave. So whenever we speak of principles of giving in the local church, mark it down. It starts with those that are touched by the grace of God and find in that grace the motivation for giving, okay? You can underline that one. That one's really more important than any of the others. Giving, principle number two. Giving should joyfully arise even in the midst of trials. Because I know some of you are going through trials, and you're like, this is not a good time for me for a money campaign. This is not a good time for me and my family. Giving principle number two. Giving should joyfully arise even in the midst of trials. Look at verse 2. It says that in a great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty. Stop there. Paul writes that the Macedonian Christians gave not because they were rich, not because they had a lot of money in storage and didn't know what to do with it, not because the economy was on an upswing. They gave in the midst of a great ordeal of affliction, if that weren't enough, and then it says, and it doesn't say poverty. Please look at it. It says deep poverty. It's a weird expression, deep poverty, like deep riches. What's deep poverty? It means you're really poor. This is shocking. This is a sermon in and of itself. This is a slap to our face living in America. They gave out of affliction and deep poverty. Any excuse any of us has, including myself, for not giving just got erased by that comment. You better spend some time looking and studying on that alone. Great is the word polis. You can't change that word. It means great. And it goes with affliction, phlipsis, all kinds of afflictions they would have in the New Testament church. Dr. MacArthur says high taxes, slavery, low economic status, and persecution had all reduced the Macedonian believers to abject poverty. Wow. Their circumstances, though, did not quench their joy. Joy is one of the great themes in the letter to the Philippians. In Philippians 4:4, many of you have memorized this. Rejoice in the Lord always. And then that wasn't enough. He says, again, what? I will say rejoice. They did not have a lot of money. In fact, they were in deep poverty. And Paul says, rejoice in the Lord. Do it again. They had a lot of joy. You know the old song, Money Can't Buy Love. Someone needs to write another song, Money Can't Buy Joy Either. Joy comes from knowing Christ. Joy comes from having the deep confidence that if I give to God, I can never outgive him. And it's not a cliche, it's a belief. Often the poor look at their circumstances and say, I can't give. Man, we're just eating rice and potatoes at our house. Listen to me very carefully. Your income has nothing to do with whether you give or not. Some of you don't believe that. This text is saying your income has nothing to do with whether or not you give. You could be making $200,000 a year. You could be making less than $20,000 a year. God still wants you to respond to his grace and give. God promises to bless you with his joy. God does not promise to make you rich. That's a false promise from false prophets. Well, I would like to preach it and go on, but I got to move on. It's a whole sermon in and of itself. We need to deal with that. God does promise to meet your needs. God also promises to reveal his faithfulness to you. I've learned a few things through my pancreatic cancer that as a father and as a husband, I really can't take care of my wife and my children. I thought I could, and you probably think you can. How can a man take care of his family when he can't even guarantee he could take care of himself? If you think about it, none of you really are providing for your families. Sorry. God just lets you think that. The Lord above provides everything that you have, including your health and your job and your hands and your head to think and figure stuff. Every good thing given and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. James 1:17. God also provides joy. Money doesn't provide joy. Money doesn't bring lasting joy. Money brings hoopla for the moment and then boredom and then worry and then anger and then isolation. Don't believe me? This world is filled with rich people who are lonely and bored. I remember the billionaire down in Atlanta. His name is escaping me right now. The guy with the TV, Ted Turner. He said once, and I shared this with one of the community groups, he said, really, you only need $100 million in life to do the things that you would like to do. So he had billions. He didn't need all that. He just needed $100 million. If you do $100 million, you could do everything in life that you want to do. So I think poorer members of the church might think, hey, it's up to the rich to carry the load. I mean, I don't have anything. Look at my car. I parked next to that other guy's car. He's got a Lexus. Mine was in the shop all week. So you hold back. You even get irritated when we talk about increasing giving. That is a wrong understanding as to why we give. There is great joy in giving. Great joy in participating in the work of the Lord through giving. I learned the joy of giving mostly from my mom. My mom would give away everything if we let her. My mom would literally give away her health if she knew it would save someone else's health. She has more compassion than a person should be allowed to have. And I learned the joy of giving from her. The account of Jesus' multiplication of the loaves and the fishes to feed 5,000 men, that wasn't counting the women and children, emphatically demonstrates that if you have only a little tiny to give to the Lord, put it in his hands. And when you put the little tiny bit in his hands, what does he do with it? He multiplies it. But he doesn't multiply it until you put it in his hands. Well, I don't have anything. You just tuck it away. They're not going to miss it. It's just $20. Your little matters. Why does it matter? Because your little is an act of faith and joy, and God will greatly increase it. Folks, God doesn't actually need our money. He wants our faith. That's why we must give. I'm not going to get very far today. I noticed. Principle number three. Those long announcements earlier in the day. It was a good announcement. It was good. Principle number three, the joy of giving results in generosity. The joy of giving results in generosity. Look at the end of verse 2. Overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. You have three great words there. Overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. Some people in the world want to be known as wealthy. Other people in the world want to be known as wealthy givers. There's a big difference, isn't there? Notice the words that are used here, overflowed. In Greek, that's parasuo, to abound, implying to give with abundance, with bounty. It's used with the term wealth, plutos, financial riches it's talking about. And with the third word there, liberality, indicating simplicity of giving. In other words, the money came and flowed easily from them. It was not pried out of their hands finger by finger. Paul did not have to squeeze those guys just to get one Roman penny out of them. They heard of the need and they were joyful in Christ and they gave and it flowed. What a contrast verse 2 paints. They had much affliction, deep poverty, but they overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. Almost doesn't even make sense. Deep poverty overflowing with a wealth of liberality. They pulled out whatever they had and presented it to the gospel ministry because of joy. Their poverty overflowed into the wealth of giving. Unheard of. This is unheard of. Only the transforming power of the gospel can do that to people. I mean, people hang on to money. Come on. People find their status by their money. People find their security and safety by their money. Not these guys. They found it all in their giving. They were safer giving. Their status was that of giving. Their heart was of giving. Salvation joy motivates giving. Do you remember Zacchaeus, the wee little man? Climbed up into the sycamore tree. Luke 19:8 records his words after he got saved. Behold, Lord, half of my possessions I will give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much. Jesus said salvation has come to this household. Not because money buys salvation, but because it indicates salvation. Conversely, where there is less joy, there's going to be less giving. When you see in life your cup, it's half empty. You look at the cup and you look at it. There it is. It's half empty. That's how you describe it. You know the illustration. Well, then how are you going to have joy because God is holding back from you rather than looking at the bottom half of the cup and saying, look what he gave me. Look at the top. Look what I don't have. Look at the bottom. Wow, look what I have. Look at the top. But I don't have that. Which one's going to give more? The ones that are looking at the bottom of the cup. When you see that your cup has more in it than you should ever be allowed to have in this life, giving doesn't sound so bad. As we read in verse 2, you can't but think of that poor widow's contribution, right? Jesus observing the people giving in the temple treasury. You got to understand, this temple was beautiful. It was big. There's marble and gold all over the place. So widow's coming in. I got her with a cane. I don't know if she has it or not, you know. Bring in her little penny. Look at all the gold and the marble and all these Pharisees and the Sadducees and priests dressed in the best garment. And she's coming in and she's coming in and she drops that in. And Jesus pulls the disciple aside. Do you see this lady gave more than all the others today? What are you talking about? Nobody even noticed the lady. No, she gave more. Well, Jesus is never wrong, so he's got to be right. She gave more. What does it mean? She gave, he said, out of her poverty and out of her need, she gave. When God looks down from heaven, it's bum ba da da. Did you see that? That's the way to give. And she didn't look at the temple and all the rich people and say, they have enough. Because she wasn't giving it to them. Do you think she received a reward from the Lord? Paul went through an awful lot of persecution. You really track how many times this guy was shipwrecked and how many times he was beaten and imprisoned. And then he writes this ridiculous thing in Romans 8. He says, the suffering of this present age isn't even worthy to be compared with the glory God's going to show to us. Well, he suffered a lot. I was like, I haven't suffered half of what he suffered. I mean, big deal. I made sacrifices earlier in life. I mean, people suffer around the world. Their contribution and their sacrifice for the ministry is 20 times what we do, 50 times what we do. Some of them shed their blood. I'm thinking this to myself in comparison. I'm like, and it's those people who suffer so badly that say, wow, this suffering's nothing. What God's going to give to us in the next life, that's everything. Yes, life is hard. It was hard for her, but she overflowed in her giving. Principle number 4, not to stop with this one. Giving is both proportional and sacrificial. Please again, look at verse 3. For I testify that according to their ability and beyond their ability, according to ability, that's kata, the preposition kata, according to what they were able to give. But then he says, and beyond their ability, that's amazing. So we stop right there again. There's the principle. Giving is both proportional and sacrificial. And Paul says, I'm a personal witness of what they gave. I testify. And he was saying that for the sake of the Corinthians, who hadn't given as much as the Macedonians. He wanted the Corinthians to give as much as the Macedonians. A little bit of competition here. The man was a master. But look what they're giving. What are you going to rise up now and do, you know? He was not ashamed of that. They're giving this. What are you going to give? An example to spur on their giving. So he writes these two ways they give. According to their ability, what does that mean? That means that they gave the way they're supposed to give. You make this amount and you give the amount that's proportional to what it is that you make. If you earn X amount, then you kind of give in proportion to X amount. If you earn XX amount, then you give in proportion to that. Give what you can. In the book, Developing a Giving Church, it gives this story. Quote, John Allen Lavender tells the story of a pastor who, after making an appeal at his church for faith promise, a certain woman, a member of the church, came to him and handed him a check for $50, asking at the same time if her gift was satisfactory. The pastor immediately replied, if it represents you. There was a moment of soul-searching thought, and she asked to have the check returned to her. She left with it. And a day or two later, she returned, handing the pastor a check for $5,000. And again, asked the same question, is my gift satisfactory? The pastor gave the same answer as before, if it represents you. As before, a truth seemed to be driving deeply. After a few moments of hesitation, she took back the check and left. Later in the week, she came again with a check. That time it was for $50,000. As she placed it in the pastor's hand, he shouldn't have taken that check, by the way. That's another story. She placed it in the pastor's hand. She said, after earnest, prayerful thought, I have come to the conclusion that this gift does represent me, and I am happy to give it. That illustrates what proportionally means. 1 Corinthians 16:2 also teaches this principle. On the first day of every week, each one of you is to put aside and save as he may prosper. Proportional. But here is the thing. These Macedonians We're not going to be outdone by anybody. They wanted the Super Bowl of giving. They were sold out for the Lord Jesus. They did not just give according to their ability, but beyond, para, beyond their ability. The ESV translates it this way, for they gave according to their means, as I can testify, and beyond their means, of their own accord. No one twisted their arm. How do you give beyond your means? Well, there's only one way to answer that. Sacrificially. In other words, the giving hurt them financially to make that contribution. But they still had joy and gave anyway. Some would call this irresponsible money management. Paul and God hold it up as a godly and wise example to be followed. Why? Because faith always honors God more than any other kind of giving. When it hurts the most and one trusts God, that's the one that gets God's attention the most. Faith giving rests in the power and faithfulness of God, unlike any other kind of gift. Jesus never called faith giving irresponsible. He only commended it when it was done with the right heart. The obedience of faith pleases God very much. One missionary who sacrificed his life put giving this way. And you know the quote, but it fits here so perfectly. He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. Now that's an eternal perspective on money. Wouldn't you agree? We'll continue, Lord willing, next Lord's Day with more of these principles. I trust it challenges all of our hearts, myself included. I'm going to pray and then we're going to have our baptism service. Father in heaven, please work with our hearts. Thank you for being patient with us. Thank you, Father, for the mature reception of this teaching on the part of Hope Bible Church. I pray you work in each family and help each family to wrestle in their love and their relationship and their trust in you. We ask it in Christ's name.